The UK Investor Magazine podcast is brought to you in association with Oanda, the broker of choice for traders who want a smarter way to trade. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year's subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
For today's podcast, we're going to be delving into a London-listed investment trust in the Temple Bar Investment Trust. And to do that, we're very kindly joined by Ian Lance, who is the portfolio manager at Temple Bar. So, Ian, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure.
Regular listeners to the podcast will be aware that Ian presented at the UK Investor Magazine Virtual Investment Trust Conference about a month ago now. So if you want to go and have a look at that presentation, do check that out. That's on the video section of the UK Investor Magazine website. So we're going to be discussing how things have changed since then, looking at the portfolio, as well as going into the larger themes across the Temple Bar Investment Trust portfolio. And we're going to be discussing the value investing. We'll be looking at some key statistics behind value investments. But before we do that, Ian, would you be able to give us a bit of introduction to yourself, please, and the portfolio and trust?
Yes, certainly. So Temple Bar is an investment trust, which is it's nearly 100 years old now, actually. And I guess, like a lot of investment trusts, its objective is to provide people, investors, with a reasonable income, to grow that income, and also to give them a capital return, which is sort of fairly generic, isn't it? I think what it's probably well known for, and actually these days it's increasingly rare, is its value investing style. This is something that has been a characteristic of Temple Bar since before we took the management over. And on that note, the trust is actually run by myself and my co-manager, Nick Purvis. Nick and I have been working together since 2007. We have both been running money now for, believe it or not, about 35 years, actually. And again, we're best known for our value investing style. I'm sure we can get into that, what exactly that means later on.
Yes, we will do. Actually, I think, Ian, that's probably a good place to start with. Yeah. You know, exploring, why are you value investors, and you know, what is the definition? Obviously, it's a style that people speak about, but it'd be good to get your perspective on value and how you see yourself as a value investor.
Yeah, sure. So the reason we're value investors, and this is going to make people laugh, is that we like to make our lives easy. And when I say that, what I mean is that there's an awful lot of empirical evidence that suggests that value investing is one of three factors that actually delivers an excess return over time. We've used a study from an American firm called Research Affiliates. I just recently actually produced a blog in which I looked at the Credit Suisse Investment Returns Handbook. All of these different studies all point to the same broad conclusions, which is that there are three factors which deliver excess returns over time. One of those is value investing. One of them is momentum investing, and one of them is size. Interestingly, they also all suggest that quality investing and growth investing do not produce an excess return over time. And the reason I said that will make people smile is that I know a lot of people will be familiar with the fact that over the last decade, actually quality and growth has been a great place to be. Interestingly, that the last 10 years have been the exception. And again, on the presentation that you referenced earlier on, we actually had a slide there in which we showed value versus growth by decade over the last 110 years. There've only been two decades out of that 110 year time period in which growth has beaten value. And it was the 1920s and the 2010s. Now, of course, the relevance of that, there are two things to note. Obviously the 2010s is people's lived experience, isn't it? People know that that's what people have seen in the last decade. But I guess the second point that I would note is that there are similarities between those two decades, aren't they? The roaring 20s and what we saw in the 2010s. You know, we have very low interest rates in both of those periods and sort of remarkable asset bubbles in both of those decades. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that growth beating value is the exception, not the norm. So that's kind of why we're value investors. What does value investing mean to us? Very simply, we believe that most investors, unfortunately, tend to have behavioural traits which cause them to overreact to news flow, which frankly doesn't really change the long run intrinsic value of a business. So when things are going well, people tend to extrapolate that forward, and they end up overpaying for things. And then they do the opposite at the bottom to when things are going badly, and that could be an economy, it could be an industry, or it could be a company. People get very, very depressed about it, and they just can't see how things are going to get any better. And the reality is that in most cases, actually, the long run intrinsic value of a business is not really changed that much by, you know, even a sort of couple of year downturn in earnings. And yet share prices move by much, much more than that. And so what that means for a value investor is that it means the share prices will move around by a lot more than is warranted in the intrinsic value of the business. And that presents an opportunity to you as a value investor. So if you can take a contrarian and long-term view and think about where a profit's going on a five-year basis and value a business off that, you will often find that people's short-term overreaction is presenting you with an opportunity because it's driven the share price down to significantly less than its intrinsic value. And I guess just to finish there, if we can find a business where we think the share price is trading at roughly half of what we think it's worth, then that is normally a good opportunity for the portfolio.
And we'll be speaking a little bit later on in the podcast about some of those opportunities that you're looking at, and of course included in the portfolio. But I just want to stay with the concept of value investing at the moment and sort of look at, you know, where we are with it, because you obviously mentioned over the last 10 years it was outperformed by growth, and you listed a number of reasons why that was. I mean, do you feel when you look at value investing and people being a value investor or funds classing their mandate and their way that they manage their fund as value? I mean, is this something that, you know, over the last 10 years diminished to some extent purely because what's been happening out there in the markets? I mean, if you look at the S&P 500, for example, as well as the NASDAQ, you've got 10 companies that are really leading these broad indices. And you know, that would then translate through to global indices as well. So if you're not in these growth stocks, or haven't been in these growth stocks for the last 10 years, you would have underperformed the market. I mean, from your perspective, Ian, at what point does it start to shift and people start to look at value and they start to pay more attention to multiples, earnings multiples, revenue multiples, and saying actually there's value here, as opposed to just looking at stocks that you know, have had some top line growth, but you just look at these companies for what's happening there on the numbers side, as opposed to the valuation? You know, from your perspective, when does it shift over again, or has it already shifted, or are we in the process of it shifting to a case where people start to pay more attention to the value valuation as opposed to investing in growth at any cost?
Yeah, I think it started actually, Jonathan. And I mean, you know, let's give you a couple of numbers to start with. So I mentioned that we took Temple Bar over a couple of years ago. Since we took it over, so this was the end of October 2020, the fund is up 85% versus the all share 45%. So, you know, there's a little data point to suggest that actually maybe things have started to swing back in the direction of value quite aggressively. What occurred over that time period? There are a couple of things, aren't there? Number one is we had that just classic overreaction as we went into the pandemic and lockdown. So people just became, you know, very, very negative about anything that was cyclically oriented. You know, to give you an example, believe it or not, the share price of NatWest Group got to a lower point in 2020 during the pandemic than it did in 2008 when the UK government stepped in and bailed it out. That is how depressed people were. So your starting point was very, very low share prices. And I think as soon as it became clear that the pandemic was going to be a temporary, not a permanent thing, that you had a big rebound. But the other thing that's happened over that time period is that the monetary conditions, the fiscal and monetary conditions that have existed over the last decade, and which I think were so positive for quality and growth, look like they've come to an end. So, you know, we had a decade, didn't we, of we've had 40 years, but in particular a decade of declining interest rates and money printing. And in that sort of environment, asset classes just went crazy, and you just basically needed to be in almost the most speculative areas of the market to get the greatest returns. That clearly came to an end, didn't it? Just over a year ago, when, contrary to what the central banks had said, inflation turned out not to be transitory. They started to put interest rates up. And I think people recognised that there was potentially a regime change underway. And this is normally how these periods end. These sort of boom periods don't go on forever. And it feels to us like the background has very much shifted. So we've gone from a situation, haven't we, where we had, negative or zero or negative interest rates a couple of years ago, to one where, you can now get close to 5% on a 2-year treasury. And that is a very, very different background. And I think in that sort of environment, all of a sudden, people are focusing back on fundamentals. They're focusing back on valuations. And the good thing for us is that actually there aren't too many of us left in the market who actually do that sort of stuff, because most people threw the towel in over the last decade and have shifted to becoming quality or growth investors.
I mean, I think it's an interesting point actually that might touch on quickly, Ian. You know, obviously you're based here in the UK, and people will compare you to the FTSE 100 and UK indices.
That's right.
I mean, has that been a godsend for you? Because if over the last 10 years you were trying to go up against the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ taking a value approach, that would have been a tough job, wouldn't it?
It very much would have, yeah. You're right. Not only did that market go up a lot more than the UK market, the returns were focused in a very small number of stocks, weren't they? A very small number of increasingly large stocks, the FANG stocks and a few others. And yeah, I know a few global value investors who had an absolutely torrid time. Conversely, though, funnily enough, actually, last year was an amazing year for most of them, because frankly, just not owning any of those stocks, gave you an incredible tailwind. You're absolutely right. I probably would have rather been a UK investor than a global value investor over the last decade.
Indeed. Right. Ian, now let's get into the portfolio and where you see opportunities. So, I mean, let's start off, quite broadly. Of course, it's UK. But are there any particular sectors that you like at the moment? Or I think it's probably a second part to this question, about the portfolio. Are you sort of out and out, bottom up, stock specific, or do you take the macro approach and look at sectors and how things are moving there?
So to answer the second question first, we are bottom up. Now we look at things like business cycles and capital cycles, and I'll come on to talk about that a little bit more in a second. We think that it's a fool's errand to try to forecast the macro. When you consider that the Federal Reserve has, in excess of 100 economics PhDs and seems to be consistently wrong on macroeconomic forecasts, people need to be realistic with themselves that macroeconomic forecasting is extremely difficult. And not only that, but you've got to get your macroeconomic forecasts right, and you've got to get them right quicker than other people, because you've got to get them right before they've been priced in to market. So what we tend to do is we tend to actually think about macroeconomics as we exploit other people's overreaction to macroeconomics. So the last few years we've already mentioned the pandemic, when anything that was remotely cyclical just got sold down to crazily low valuations, and we saw that as an opportunity. And we had a similar sort of thing happened when the war in Ukraine started. So we're definitely bottom up, not top down. We do though, when it comes to certain industries, we employ what's called a capital cycle approach. And I think that's probably, it's probably best if I give you an example of that. And so the sector that I'm going to talk about, the energy sector, because that's 20% of the trust at the moment. So it's the biggest sector in the trust. And there are the capital cycle thesis is that basically you have these industries which are very capital intensive, and they tend to have very long lead times on investment in the industry. So, you know, in the case of oil and gas, you know, you obviously you can't just create a new oil well overnight. These things take years. And we've had this position for maybe 3 or so years, and there were two elements to it. The first one is that for maybe very positive reasons, lots of investors decided about 3 or 4 years ago that they hated the energy sector for ESG reasons, and they just emptied their portfolios of energy stocks. And of course, that depressed the valuations of these companies, and it meant that they were trading at very, very low valuations relative to their long run average. But what's more interesting was what was going on within the industry at the same time, which is that the industry, like lots of these industry, goes through sort of boom bust periods. And the last boom, you have to go back to about 2013. And of course, you know, that you've got overinvestment, the commodity prices in general went down quite a lot, and then that certainly impacted the energy industry. But at the same time, the you know, lots of investors were employing those ESG ideas in the way that they communicated with the companies, and they basically told the companies that they should stop investing in anything related to fossil fuels. And the companies certainly took that to heart, because believe it or not, upstream energy capex adjusted for GDP is 70% lower today than it was 10 years ago, which is just, you know, just a staggering statistic, how much capital has come out of that industry. And in this sort of industry, you can't cut capital expenditure by that amount and expect production levels to remain at the same levels that they were at, you know, 10 years ago. And of course, that hasn't happened, and production has not really grown. People thought demand, I think they thought demand was going to collapse because we're all going to be driving around in EVs and so on and so forth. Again, that's just not going to happen overnight. And of course, demand for fossil fuels continues to grow, fueled by the growth in places like China and India and Africa. So you've got this situation where you eventually ended up with a tightness in supply and demand in the energy industry, and that's what drove up oil and gas prices. And it's worth saying that this was happening before the situation with Ukraine. You know, when that happened, it undoubtedly poured fuel on the fire, but you had energy prices going up very significantly, and the cash flows of these companies are very geared to commodity prices, and you know, they reacted, and the cash flows of these companies went up very, very significantly. And I suppose just to finish off, ordinarily what you would expect in this sort of capital cycle is that you know, the solution that people sometimes say, don't they, the solution to high prices is high prices. And what they mean by that is it should encourage investment. That's certainly what should happen here. When the oil price was over $100, you should have seen companies' capital expenditure started to go up very, very significantly. And it hasn't, because both investors and politicians have continued to tell them that, you know, they are the spawn of Satan and they mustn't invest. And they've not invested. So and then we've seen things like windfall taxes and all sorts of other crazy things. And so capital expenditure hasn't gone up. And therefore what you've seen is free cash flow has just remained at very, very elevated levels. The companies are, because they're not investing, they are responding by increasing dividends, buying back their shares. And yet they are still trading at very, very low valuations. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, our thesis on the energy sector.
So, I mean, the cash generation of those businesses is tremendous. But interesting point, you mentioned there that of the portfolio, is it 20%?
Yes.
Right, oil and gas. So do you think, and this is making comparisons to the composition of the London's leading index, of course, the FTSE 100, would you be as heavily invested, do you feel, within that sector if there wasn't such a strong weighting in the FTSE 100 towards natural resources? Do you feel the strong weighting towards, of course, the two oil companies, BP and Shell, and then the miners, makes that index, I mean, particularly today, if you're looking at what's happening to the FTSE 100, it's the miners and the oil companies lifting that index. Do you feel that if that index wasn't as heavily weighted towards natural resources and oil and gas, that you would be as heavily weighted with 20% of the portfolio in that sector?
Yes, I do. We're pretty index agnostic, actually. I didn't mention earlier on, we run a very focused portfolio, so we're quite happy to run a portfolio with sort of, you know, 20, 25 stocks in it. We are very happy to take big index bets in both directions. So if we, you know, if there are big shares or big sectors which we think are expensive, we're quite happy to have absolutely nothing in them, even if they're a big part of the index. So even if I was running a global value portfolio, I suspect energy would probably represent that sort of weight in it, because it remains, I think, one of our most positive areas, because the valuations are still so low. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the valuations of our top 10 holdings. BP, Shell, and Total trade on 6x earnings, and you know, they've got dividend yields of sort of 4% or so, but they're buying back huge amounts of stock as well. So you've got very low valuations, and at the moment the fundamentals for the industry remain very positive because everyone continues to tell these companies not to invest, and frankly, if we don't do something to increase supply, it's kind of hard to see how energy prices are going to come back down.
Yeah, and that's a win-win situation for those companies. So going back to the broader market, Ian, when you're looking at, you know, the FTSE 100, FTSE 350, it's been considered cheap for some time, and you know, for you as a value investor, an ideal place to be looking for opportunities. And of course, it's a relative term, the value and cheapness. It's comparisons to European indices, comparisons to US indices.
Yeah.
When do you see, and what may be the catalyst for the UK market to not be as cheap or offer as good value compared to these overseas markets?
Yeah, this is a difficult one, but I suppose just to start on that point of relative and absolute cheapness, we think the UK is relatively cheap. So we have a chart that looks at the valuation of the UK versus the world stock market, and it actually goes back 50 years. It goes back to the 1970s, and you know, people will say, oh, well, the UK should trade at a discount because of its sector composition, and actually I'd agree with that. But interestingly, the average discount for the UK over the MSCI World has been about 17% for the last 50 years, and today we're at about a 40% discount. So we're a lot cheaper than the long run average. But we would also say that lots of these shares look cheap on an absolute basis as well. You know, we can kind of talk about some of these companies later on, but you know, we think that sort of the average PE across the portfolio is probably about 9x. It's pretty much the cheapest that we've seen in our investing careers, which goes back 35 years. So we think the UK is both absolutely and relatively cheap. To answer your second question about sort of, you know, what might the catalyst be, that's a really difficult one, because so many investors these days, unfortunately, and I'm talking actually about sort of institutional investors and, you know, big wholesale investors, they actually have a market cap mindset. And what I mean by that is that when they look at where they're going to allocate to equities, they'll look at the US market, which is currently just shy of 70% of MSCI World. And then they'll look at the UK, and the UK is about 5%. And, you know, there's just no way in the world they're going to have sort of half their money in the UK. And in actual fact, what's been going on is actually the opposite. I'm sure you've kind of discussed this before. There've been big outflows from the UK. And so you've also almost had this kind of self-perpetuating thing whereby big institutional investors, pension funds and so on and so forth, have been selling down the UK, depressing the valuation of it, depressing the weighting, and vice versa. That money's been going into global, it's been going into the US. And it's not easy to see what reverses that, unless, you know, all of a sudden some of these institutions turn around and actually think to themselves, this is crazy. The US is probably sort of nearly as expensive as it's been in its history. The UK is nearly as cheap as it's been in its history, and we've got 5 in the cheap one and 70 in the expensive one. That's probably not going to happen. So what can happen? I think these things basically can just form on their own. And what I mean by that is, if you've got a stock, I don't know, with a free cash flow yield of, let's call it 12%, and it's paying out, let's call it a sort of 5%, 5 or 6% dividend a year, that's getting you to nearly your total equity return on its own, isn't it? So you only need, you know, a little bit of income growth out of that to give you a reasonable return. And we're making the assumption here that these things don't derate forever. And then, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that actually you do get a little bit of a re-rating over time. And of course that then, you know, exaggerates your return. So it might just be that some of these companies, that's how you get your return. It's you don't get your return because all of a sudden lots of investors start throwing money at the UK market. You just get it because they can kind of sit there and compound at 8, 9, 10% per annum, given the low starting valuations, the fact that they are paying you a dividend, the fact they're growing their income, the fact that they're buying back very, very cheap stocks. I think one final thing that I'll mention is that we still think it's possible that you'll see takeovers because, number one, the valuations of lots of these companies are very cheap, as we've just discussed. And of course, number two, if you're let's say a US buyer, you're sitting there looking at UK assets in quite a cheap currency at the moment as well. So it wouldn't surprise us to see some sort of corporate activity going on as well.
So we'll just finish on that point there before moving on to look at the individual companies in the portfolio. That notion that there's potential value there because it could be takeovers coming in for UK listed companies.
Yeah.
I mean, what we're seeing at the moment is, you know, the likes of Arm choosing to list in the United States. There's CRH that's been looking at moving over their listing to the United States as well. You know, if we see a trend of that where companies are being seen as good value and being taken over, and these are good quality companies. Morrisons, for example, is one that's been taken over recently and been removed from the indices. You know, if that happens, are you concerned that we aren't seeing the number of companies coming in, high quality companies coming in to replace those? And do you think over time that's a bit of a negative for UK markets?
In the very, very long term, yes. I mean, I suppose if you put the question, can we produce a portfolio at the moment that's reasonably diversified and very undervalued? The answer is yes, we can. But that's because we run quite focused money. I have to say, it's something that I wouldn't particularly want to see is lots and lots of companies beginning to just disappear off the UK market, either because they shift their listing or because they just get taken over. And actually, it is a slight concern of ours, and it would be a nice problem to have, wouldn't it? Would be that some of these companies are so cheap that people could come in and offer you a sort of 30 or 40% premium,
of course,
and would get taken out. And in actual fact, we would be sitting there saying, hang on a second, we thought there was 100% upside.
Yes, nice problem to have. A nice problem, of course. The price that it's done will dictate those returns. So we're going to move on now, Ian, and we're going to look at the individual companies. So this is actually quite an interesting one to start with, because it's one of the attendees from the recent presentation that we did brought up, and it's IDS.
Yeah.
The old Royal Mail. And, you know, there was a question there that, of course, you're looking for value. And, you know, the integral part of value investing is you're looking for companies that aren't doing as well. Hence, there's some value there.
Yes.
You know, it's unloved by the market. So, again, two-part question here. You know, why IDS? And second point, you know, this is a company that's been You know, if you're looking at the news, it's been pretty bad recently. You know, at which point do you look at this company and say, right, we're in it because it offers value? But at what point do you say, well, not enough's enough? There's value there, but the news has been quite bad and it's not going the way that we want. You know, for a company like IDS, you know, when do you throw in a towel?
Yeah. So one of the things that we often find is that investors tend to put a lot of focus on bits of the business that they know and bits of the business which are attracting headlines. And sometimes they don't even know that there are other bits of the business. And this will be a case with IDS and Royal Mail. So, you know, obviously people know that they get their letters delivered every day. So they know the Royal Mail. They'll read about the headlines about the strikes and so on and so forth. They might not even know that this IDS basically has two businesses. It's got the UK business. We'll come back to that in a second. But it's got a European logistics business called GLS. Doesn't even do letters. All it does is parcels. Now, parcels is basically in a structural growth situation at the moment, because we're all, you know, shopping online more and more, and therefore home delivery isn't on a growth path at the moment. And GLS has been a huge beneficiary from that. So it's seen very, very consistent revenue growth. It makes a margin of about 8%. It's going to make profits, or made profits last year actually, of about £350 million. So, you know, what might that business be worth? Well, let's stick it on 10 times, and I would say 10 times is a very miserly multiple to use. That would be worth about £3.50 a share on its own. Again, as an aside, the UK business has a load of surplus property, so this would be sort of, I suppose, depots and things like that that are no longer used that they could sell off. That's worth about another £1.50 a share. So we add those two bits together, we're at £5 a share. The share price in the market today is £2.30. So the market is putting a very big negative value on the UK business today. You know, I'm sure lots of listeners will have heard the expression "margin of safety." This is something that value investors will often go on about, is buying something with a margin of safety. In other words, buying something whereby even if something goes wrong, you know, you're buying it so cheaply that you've got an inbuilt margin of safety. And we think that would apply here, because there's so much value in the two bits that I've just spoken about. Even if the, you know, the unions persist in what they're doing at the moment, we think the shares are very, very cheap. I guess if we turn to the UK business, it's worth saying that, you know, despite the best efforts of the unions, this is still a business which last year had about 10 billion of sales. Obviously, it's not making money at the moment, but if ever they got some sort of agreement on productivity improvements, it could make a margin of, we think, about 5%. That would be about 500 million quid. And you can kind of see the potential value that there could be in the UK side. So, you know, that's not going to happen overnight, but we would recognise the sort of, I suppose, the option value there, if you want to think about it like that. You know, still has the number one market share in parcels in the UK, again, despite the best efforts of the union over the last 6 months or so. So an awful lot of upside. And I suppose one final thing I'll say is, because we run quite a lot of money, and we're quite focused investors, we end up with quite large holdings in companies, and here we own about 10% of IDS, and we are the second largest investor behind a chap called Daniel Kretinsky, who's a Czechoslovakian billionaire who runs a family office called Vesa, and he owns 25% of it. So between the two of us, we own 35% of the business, and that's just relevant because it means that we have quite a lot of sway in terms of sort of value realization, etc. So hopefully that gives you a feel, I suppose, for, you know, what we're seeing, you know, despite the sort of torrent of negative news flow at the moment.
So IDS is an interesting one. Looking back over the last 5 years, you know, we're down nearer to £2 at the moment, but it's, you know, it's been up to £6 very recent times. So, I mean, how long have you been holding on to IDS? Is this one that you've been adding to recently? Have you held it throughout that 5 year period that I've got here on the chart, and or is it something that you add and take away from? I mean, how do you treat a stock like this, which is quite clearly over this period trading in a in a range. We're towards the bottom of that range now, very crudely, just looking at the chart. Is this something that you'll look to modify the position in? When did you first get into it?
So we first got into it again during COVID, when I was talking earlier on about that sort of enormous pessimism that there was in 2020 that basically threw up some real bargains. And IDS actually got close to a pound, which is just extraordinary. When you go back to what I was saying about the value of GLS, you think that the market cap of the entire group was about 1.2 billion in the summer of 2020. So it was very, very cheap. The thing that actually the market really had got wrong is that the market hadn't really thought about what lockdown would do for this business, because actually lockdown was an enormous benefit because we're all at home, so we're all shopping online. And so actually volumes absolutely went through the roof during that period. So that's kind of what drove the share price up to £6. It was the fact that business materially improved through that sort of through that lockdown period. To answer your question, yes, we it basically became a very large part of the portfolio because we bought it well. We bought it during that sort of lull in 2020. Eventually, it became nearly 9% of the portfolio, and we took some money out of it at that point of time. Really for risk control reasons. That was probably too much to have in a single stock. Yeah. And yes, we've been adding to it again over the last year or so, as the share price has been more beaten up. We don't traditionally top and tail things. We have very, very low turnover. Our turnover is literally about 10%, and there can be years in which we do nothing. When we write our report at the end of the year, and the activity page is kind of intentionally left blank. Yeah. We're not the sort of people who will trade around things, but when things are trading materially above or below our estimate of intrinsic value, that's kind of what then leads to action within the portfolio.
Fantastic. So, Ian, just to finish off with now, what are some of the big? I mean, you obviously just said that you don't make a lot of changes to the portfolio, but what are things that you've been tweaking or maybe looking at tweaking over the last 3 to 6 months, if anything?
Yeah, not an awful lot actually. I mean, funnily enough, I suppose it was sort of second half of last year, wasn't it? Investors became quite gloomy about interest rates going up, energy prices going up, recession, and then of course we had the mini budget and all that sort of stuff, and actually some of the cyclicals got again very beaten up, and we added to a few of those. So some of our retailers, like we own Marks and Spencers, I've already mentioned IDS. Another area that is a big part of the portfolio is banks, and of course that I think that's quite topical at the moment. Our view is that what is going on in the US at the moment is not a rerun of 2008, and yet investors reacted almost as if it was. We saw the share prices of things like NatWest, Barclays, Standard Chartered marked down very, very aggressively. And when you think about it, actually, there was very, very little crossover between what was going on at Silicon Valley Bank and what's going on at these banks, and. I think for a lot of people, 2008 was such a sort of terrifying experience. They've almost just put a line through the sector and just decided that they'll never invest in banks again. And again, that means that you get very, very low valuations. I mean, Barclays is recovered a little bit, but a few weeks ago, it was down onto 4x earnings and about a 7% dividend yield. Just a few weeks ago, in the middle of what was going on with Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse and so on and so forth. So we think at those sorts of valuations, the banks are attractive, and we think they're significantly better businesses than they were back in 2008. The management teams are different, loan books are different, all the sort of financial ratios are much, much better than they were back then. So that's another area that, we're still quite positive on.
So just that it's an interesting sector, of course, the banks. I mean, when you look at the banks on the valuation, you know, since the financial crisis, these banks haven't really got back above trading one times the book value.
No.
Whereas you look in the United States, then you know they trade many multiples off in some circumstances. You know, is this something that you think could change, or is this something that's just, you know, going back to that point that you made there about the financial crisis, that it's just built into the psyche of investors and UK investors that are looking at the banks, that they just don't have that confidence to take them, you know, to a premium of book value? Or do you still think that there's, you know, some questions to be asked about what the assets of these banks are?
No, I don't actually. I think it is. I think it's in the psyche of a lot of investors. A lot of people have just put a line through the sector. But you're absolutely right. You know, some of these banks are trading at half tangible book, and at the same time, the management teams are coming out and saying, you know, we're expecting to make 12, 13, 14% in the case of NatWest return on equity. And there's just no way that they should be trading on sort of half book and making those sorts of returns. Now, what, you know, of course, the right thing for the companies to do in that sort of situation is just buy back their stock, isn't it? And that's exactly what people like NatWest have been doing. And then going back to my earlier point about corporate activity, in the last few months, we've seen a couple of bid rumours for Standard Chartered, haven't we? And again, that just doesn't surprise us. You know, Standard Chartered has got a really excellent portfolio of businesses in sort of fast-growing emerging markets. And if you're and is trading at half book, if you know, if you're a big American bank trading at sort of multiples of book, and you want to buy a sort of a footprint into fast-growing emerging markets, Standard Chartered looks to me like a sort of obvious way to do that, given the valuation that it's trading on. And as I say, we have had a couple of big spikes up in the share prices on rumours of takeovers.
Indeed. That's going to be an interesting story, I think, Ian, to keep an eye on. You know, if these valuations do keep down at these levels, I think at some point in the future we'll start to see more takeover talk coming through, and that's always good. So, Ian, thank you much for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure.
And just as a final note to listeners, do check out the video section on the UK Investor Magazine website, because some of the points that Ian made there are very well illustrated on the slides. So Ian, once more, thank you very much. And thank you very much to everyone for listening. This podcast was presented by Oanda, TradingView's most popular broker. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.